Sonny, friends, welcome. This is the second of the overseas student lectures. You'll remember these public lectures commemorate the work of the Overseas Student Trust, an independent educational charity which started, I think, at the beginning of the 60s and for over 30 years set a pace in improving conditions for overseas students in Britain, as well as enhancing the development of policy in the field of international education. In the early 90s, Martin Kenyon, whom I'm delighted to see here tonight, on his retirement as director of the Trust, made the alliance, which was a natural one really, to sustain the Trust's role through the Centre for Educational Research here at LSE. And last year the series began with what was a remarkable inaugural lecture by Archbishop Tutu. And in reflecting on last year and this year, I'm surely struck, as you must be, that last year we were hearing from a man who found greatness in his life devoted to the struggle of making South Africa one nation. And tonight we're privileged to be hearing another great man who's made a worldwide reputation through his international activities. In his own land, Guyana, where I first met him many years ago, he became Minister of Justice and Minister of Foreign Affairs. And then wider still and wider, his career was set. He became Chairman of the West Indian Commission. He became Secretary General of the Commonwealth. Notable years, 75 to 90. He was twice elected Vice President of the United Nations General Assembly, and he chaired a United Nations Committee for Development Planning from 84 to 87. He played a leading part in international commissions for peace and better global governance over the years and in many different manifestations. I think that's been the mission closest to his heart, really, and it is still. He's a member now of the Carnegie Commission on Preventing Deadly Conflict. He's a member of the Council on International Negotiating Network set up by President Carter. And among many other things, he's now chairman with the Swedish Prime Minister, Carlson, of the Commission on Global Governance, whose report, which is called Our Global Neighborhood, set out far-reaching international thoughts. And the title of his own book, published in 92, pretty well says it all, Our Country, Our Planet. And among his international distinctions, I should point out that he's an honorary fellow, of course, of LSE. Also in his academic dimensions, he's a Chancellor of the University of Warwick and Chancellor of the University of the West Indies. I first met Sonny in the 50s. We both shared a great friend and hero, I think, Sonny, Lord Campbell, Jock Campbell. And Jock was a great man. He was the chairman of Booker's in those days and modernized so much around him. I remember Jock, who was a quoter of Sidney Smith, briefing me about meeting this rising star. And Jock, who loved Sidney Smith, quoted one of those phrases of praise that Sidney Smith used to use for people he really liked. He said, "He is a man of synthetic propensities." And here we have a great man of synthetic propensities on a global scale. And we're delighted to have you with us here tonight, Sonny. And we're privileged to have you address us. So, Sonny Randall.
Sir Peter Parker, Sir John, my many friends among you. It's a terrible thought, I know, but I think I know now what a memorial service must look like. There's so many, many friends among you. Friends of mine here. Wonderful. Thank you all for coming. If anything that I have to say may be worthwhile and worthy, I share the responsibility for it with you, because it is from my relationship with all of you, so many of you, that have come, flown, developed, these thoughts and these ideas. So in a way, I hope I speak for all of us. I am really specially honored to have been asked to give this lecture. Admittedly, to have to follow such a well-known spellbinder as Desmond Tutu adds a rather formidable challenge. We do have a few things in common. It was to London University and to King's across the road that I too first came to this country, some years earlier than Archbishop Tutu. But while I came to read law, he came, of course, to read theology. While British Guiana, where I came from, was still a British colony, conditions there were hardly akin to those in South Africa. The South Africa which, a year before Archbishop Tutu's coming here, had actually been made an outcast of the Commonwealth. Our experiences here, too, were very different, necessarily so. And I could hardly expect to match Bishop Tutu in the sheer warmth and exhilaration of his recounting of the highlights of his time in the country. I shall not even try to do so. I should like to try to take a rather different path. But I mean to pick up from where he left off, as it were, in his inaugural lecture last year. But first, to a few other matters. Sir Peter Parker has mentioned the presence with us of Martin Kenyon, and I do so too. For Martin figured deservedly prominently in Bishop Tutu's recollections of his own early days in London. I came to these parts, as I said, a decade too early. The Overseas Students Trust had yet to be conceived when I joined King's. And I had to wait until I returned to London and to come back to serve the Commonwealth from Marlborough House to learn about the Trust and to come to know Martin Kenyon and to appreciate his enduring concern for overseas students in this country. I became Commonwealth Secretary General in 1975, and it was towards the end of the 1970s that the British government took the decision, the misguided policy decision, whose impact was to be of so much concern to both the Commonwealth Secretariat and the Overseas Students Trust, and therefore brought us into a kind of collaborative arrangement. The British government's decision, of course, was the decision to require students entering British universities from outside the European community to pay full cost fees. And this marked a very sharp turn in British policy. And perhaps it was the suddenness and the severity of the decision that caused the greatest anguish. To those of us in the Commonwealth who were disconcerted by the seeming indifference to the adverse effects on Commonwealth countries and on Commonwealth relations, and indeed, I thought then and still think now, on Britain itself, one of the sources of encouragement, and there were not too many of them around, was the efforts made by the Overseas Students Trust to mobilize informed opinion in favor of a more enlightened approach, in favor of action that could alleviate the damage caused by the abrupt reversal of policy on student fees. My concern as Commonwealth Secretary General was not only with the impact on educational opportunities, and therefore on opportunities for national economic and social progress in developing countries, though the consequences in those respects for some countries, particularly the poorer ones, were a very real concern. I shared with many in the Commonwealth, including this country, of course, concern about the possible impact of a reduced student mobility on the interaction, the fellowship, the understanding that were among the Commonwealth's vital contributions to international well-being. One response to the situation created by the market orientation given to higher education policy was the establishment by me of the Commonwealth Committee on Student Mobility, which was ably steered by Sir Roy Marshall, whom most of you know, the Barbadian Vice Chancellor then of the University of Hull. In a series of reports, the committee monitored developments and put forward a number of suggestions for improving Commonwealth arrangements. The elevation of commercial principles, with higher education treated as an export industry, was in the event unstoppable, both here and, as you know, in due course, in the other industrialized countries of the Commonwealth. But the committee nevertheless had a very creative role in certain advances in educational collaboration undertaken by Commonwealth governments, notably, of course, such enterprises as the Commonwealth of Learning, based in Vancouver, the Distance Education Learning Center, and the Commonwealth Higher Education Support Scheme, CHESS. Throughout the years in which Commonwealth student interchange remained one of my important concerns, I knew at the Commonwealth Secretariat that we could look to the Overseas Students Trust as a resolute friend. And the partnership has endured, I'm glad to say, into later years. Martin Kenyon has been the public face of the trust, and it is difficult to imagine the trust, to imagine that it could ever have existed without him, without his dedication, without his commitment, without his energy. But I should also like to salute all those public companies with overseas interests that were enlightened enough to support the trust and to underpin its most valuable work. Commonwealth student mobility took many years to recover from the setback it suffered at the end of the 1970s. Relevant student numbers were on the downturn through most of the 1980s, and it was only in 1988 that the decline really began to be reversed. It was not until 1990, however, that the recovery took numbers actually above the levels recorded in 1978. The pickup and further improvement in student movements is, of course, cause for very great satisfaction. There are, however, reasons for disquiet about some aspects of the international educational market in which the turnaround in student flows has taken place. One is the sharp escalation in fees. This is bound to have its worst effects on the poorest countries, making the concentration in the distribution of benefits from educational opportunities abroad even more pronounced. Students from poor countries and poor students from even middle-income developing countries are greatly disadvantaged. Scholarships, of course, help and help enormously, and I commend those who labor to sustain them. For without them, the market for tertiary education will be anything but free in every sense. Another is the aggressive marketing of places pursued by some universities and other educational institutions, including purely profit-oriented commercial enterprises, which seem to constitute now a minor growth industry. Educational recruiters have now become a new breed of traveling sales representatives, making the rounds of third world capitals, advertising their products in local newspapers, and hawking them from hotel suites. There is cause to wonder if these activities, which I believe are undertaken only by a minority of institutions of varying stature, are not leading at least some students in developing countries to make the wrong choices as consumers or as purchasers of education, to use market terminology. It is also the case that in the financial environment in which higher education now has to function, fees from overseas students have become a considerable part, sometimes a vital part, of the income of many educational institutions. This seems to have created a situation in which some observers suspect that the compulsion to enroll income-generating students and to maintain such enrollments at a high level is leading some institutions, by no means all, to be somewhat flexible on admission standards for students from abroad. All these misgivings notwithstanding, the improvement in student mobility that has been registered has to be welcomed, because the wider interaction across national frontiers it makes possible, even if it is largely within elite groups. It can contribute to the goal of enlarging international goodwill and international cooperation. How the younger generation views the world has, I believe, become of even greater importance as the world has become smaller and more closely connected, as global interdependence has increased. I said I would be picking up from where Desmond Tutu left off. In the closing sentence of his lecture here last year, he said this: "We inhabit the global village, and we are sisters and brothers, members of one family." He used the phrase that Marshall McLuhan had brought into the language in the 1960s to encapsulate the transformation brought about in the world by advances in communications technology. Many further advances have been achieved since McLuhan's time to consolidate and extend that transformation, with consequences for all aspects of our affairs, including our national and our global policies. In the Commission on Global Governance that Sir Peter Parker was good enough to mention, together with my fellow co-chairman Ingvar Carlsson and our colleagues from many very different parts of the world and from a very wide range of backgrounds, we opted for the term global neighborhood as a description of the world of today. It seemed to us that neighborhood was more than a physical description, though the term is, of course, strictly value neutral. It seems to suggest, if not to stipulate, the notion of community, of neighborliness. I hasten to tell you that we were not starry-eyed. We were far from claiming the emergence of a wholly benign neighborhood. What we were convinced was that because of a number of changes in the past few decades, the world had been transformed into a neighborhood, one in which the fate of all its inhabitants would increasingly rest on their accepting neighborhood responsibilities, deepening interdependence, political, economic, ecological, was requiring all nations, all people, in their own separate interests, to be more sensitive to one another's needs, to cooperate on more and more issues, to act as good neighbors. The importance of interactions that bring the young into contact across national borders is heightened by the developments that have been ushered in the global neighborhood. But while educational mobility needs to be promoted, I believe we need also to look beyond mobility to the thrust and the content of education, to its role in inculcating values, to its contribution to the ethics of the global neighborhood. The Overseas Students Trust had from the beginning a wider vision of the world that is encompassed in the notion of us and them, local and overseas. The essence of its mission was to subdue the forces of otherness, to subdue them everywhere through education. It is to that same mission that I speak tonight. Speak against the backdrop of the work on which I have been engaged these last 3 years on the Commission on Global Governance. The two themes are actually conjoined, the trusts and the commissions. That is why I have called this lecture Education for Life in the Global Neighborhood. I speak to the reality of the global neighborhood the Commission believes the world has become. And I will try to convey why education today must help to prepare us for life in that new world. Prepare us for answering the challenge of survival in our new global neighborhood. And survival of the global neighborhood itself. The Commission on Global Governance began its work in 1992. Those, you will remember, were heady days of change. The Berlin Wall had fallen in 1989. Glasnost and Perestroika had signaled change in the USSR that was eventually to turn to cataclysm in the breakup of the Soviet Union. The Cold War was over. It seemed a time of opportunity for international cooperation. Commissions before ours had addressed specific areas of global affairs. Brandt had dealt with development, Palme with security, Brundtland with environment, Nyerere with the South. All had a bearing on survival, and their recommendations in substantive policy areas still command attention. What the end of the post-war era both allowed and required was work on how. How were we going to manage human affairs so that in these and other fields of global endeavor, we could answer the challenge of survival? Our central task was to suggest how world governance could be developed and improved to enlarge the probabilities of success. We called our report Our Global Neighborhood, a signal we thought of the kind of world that globalization and technological change were creating. We saw that title as a reasonable description of a physical reality, under no illusion, as I said, that it was a wholly benign neighborhood, cohesive, integrated, or secure. What it reflected was simply the reality of the human condition. But we saw the title also as embodying an aspiration for a neighborhood evolving in worthier ways, a fulfillment to which global governance, we thought, had much to contribute. We have just passed the 50th anniversary year, of the founding of the United Nations. 50 years since June 1945 in San Francisco. A month ago, last month, we have just marked the 50th anniversary of the first ever meeting of the UN General Assembly, held here in London on the 10th of January 1946 in Central Hall, Westminster. That makes this inescapably a time for asking questions about global institutions and about world order, a time for examining the adequacy of our systems for securing human survival on our planet, and a time for assessing what prospects we are passing on to future generations. Among the answers to our questions, one surely, I suggest, must command consensus. That we are at a new time, that we need a new order in world affairs, a new style of managing our relations as human beings on this planet, a new way of relating as humans to the planet. This much, I believe, we know, all of us, in our hearts, and acknowledge, most of us, in some measure, in our minds. It is the business of in some measure that is the problem. The Commission believes that the quintessential feature of our new world is that cooperation is no longer merely an option. It is a precondition of life in the global neighborhood. It is not just a strategic choice. It is a compulsion of civilized human existence. It is indispensable, for example, if we want to maintain international peace and order, to expand economic activity, to tackle pollution, to check greenhouse warming, to combat pandemic disease, to curb the spread of weapons, to prevent deserts growing, to preserve genetic diversity, to save species from extinction, to deter terrorists, to ward off famine, to defeat economic recession, to share scarce resources, to beat drug traders. And matters calling for global cooperation are constantly pressing their claims upon us, from overfishing in the North Atlantic to rogue financial traders in Singapore. The Commission is not unique in its perceptions. Large numbers of people share them and understand by a new order nothing less than the birth of a new world, one in which our human citizenry simply must live as global neighbors if we are to fulfill our hopes for 21st century civilization. Nor is the global neighborhood a novel perception. In his very first inaugural address on the 4th of March, 1933, another time of uncertainty, in some ways not unlike the present, President Roosevelt counseled his fellow Americans. In the field of world policy, he said, "I would dedicate this nation to the policy of the good neighbor." But what was evident in crisis grew fainter with prosperity. Reforming the global order is, of course, in part a process of institutional change. But more fundamentally, it involves learning to live by neighborhood values. The broad acceptance of a global civic ethic to guide action within the global neighborhood is absolutely vital to the quality of our responses. There is need for common commitment to a set of core values that can unite people of all cultural, political, religious, or philosophical backgrounds. Values appropriate to the needs of an increasingly crowded and diverse planet that all humanity could and must uphold. The Commission sees these as rights and responsibilities embodied over time in a binding international instrument, a kind of global charter for civil society, as a basis for people from different cultures and countries to agree on the rules that should govern the global neighborhood. Shared values for a troubled world, if you like, could be its theme. Without such conscious values, we are unlikely ever to become good neighbors, or to make the global neighborhood a good place for all. I recognize the question of values as one not everywhere appreciated. We are all a little myopic and tend to intolerance. Notions of a clash of civilizations only enlarge confusion. The Commission was clear in its perceptions. Living by neighborhood values cannot rest on the primacy of any one value system. The global neighborhood is enriched by its many cultures. Mutual respect for each other's cultural values is an essential ingredient of neighborhood values. This means something more than tolerance in its narrow sense. It really means the celebration, not just the acceptance of difference. It means more than cultures subsumed in a melting pot. It means cultures harmonized, as in a bouquet of flowers. Radiance, glorifying human civilization in all its variety. The duty of care for our neighbor is perhaps the foremost of neighborhood values. In a neighborhood, all our neighbors. In our global neighborhood, our duty of care is owed to all who share the planet. This duty is the more compelling, of course, the more a neighbor needs care. Today, high among those who stand in need of care are the poor, the 1 in 4 or 5 of its people that the world's remarkable economic progress has simply bypassed. The ranks of the abjectly poor have actually continued to grow. When we were completing the work on the first Brandt Commission's report at the end of the 70s, the World Bank estimated there were around 800 million in absolute poverty. That term you will remember that Robert McNamara had used a few years earlier to stir the world's conscience on human deprivation. UNDP's Human Development Report put the figure at 1.3 billion for 1993. Over 50% more. These figures give an idea of the scale of the problem and even more significantly of the trend. The dazzling performance of several developing countries, particularly in Asia, has, I think, tended to blur a less admirable aspect of the economic changes of the post-war world. The relentless growth in the number of the very poor. Though the global economy has expanded fivefold in the last 4 decades, it has not rooted out dire poverty or even reduced its prevalence. Even some very successful countries have not managed to eliminate poverty. In the result, and I was very glad to see this highlighted this week at the World Economic Forum, bringing together some of the world's principal corporate executives and international governments. A sophisticated, globalized, increasingly affluent world currently coexists globally and within countries with a marginalized underclass. The unfettered forces of the market tend to make a few very rich and to leave very many very poor. The resulting insecurities that afflict the hungry, the homeless, the destitute, the unemployed, those who are ill without health care, those who are cold without heating, those who are old without social support, those insecurities are very real indeed. For them, security is a meal, a roof, a job, medicines, warmth, and relief from poverty in general. Their insecurities may be more chronic than the physical insecurities of war or repression. But I suggest to you that they are as real and that they are as pressing and should command our attention every bit as much. These insecurities now afflict hundreds of millions of people. We respond to them when they reach the proportions of an Ethiopia or a Somalia. But for the most part, we avoid thinking of these calamities. We can no longer. We put them out of our mind as occurring in distant places, but no place on our planet is any longer far away. The hopes, the fears, the achievements of these people bear on our own. Their insecurities are our insecurities, their crises are not their crises alone. The global neighborhood is not a mirage. Like all other neighborhoods, it has to be good for all its people if in the longer term it is to be good for any of them. Nor is this a wholly new understanding of security. It reflects, after all, that kinship between freedom from fear and freedom from want that the Atlantic Charter and later the UN's founding conference in San Francisco itself had underlined. Only a sense of caring and solidarity with the poor as fellow human beings can inspire more resolute action to help them work their way out of deprivation. That sense of neighborly care has found expression in an expanding network of voluntary agencies that engage in humanitarian and development work in their own countries and abroad. The Overseas Students Trust is one of them. The generosity of citizens has shown up, by contrast, the parsimony of governments. As within nations, so within the global neighborhood, however, private and individual voluntary action, while valuable, cannot be a substitute for public or community efforts, not just to relieve poverty, but to combat its causes so that it may be eradicated. Concern for the underprivileged of the world must be a more dominant influence in the global neighborhood, and institutional structures must allow it to be. One of the more distressing trends of which reform of the global order must respond has been the rise in racial and religious extremism and chauvinism, part of what is called the politics of identity. Some nationalist movements have displayed crudely xenophobic edges. Ethnic cleansing has brought death to thousands and displacement and suffering to millions. In some parts of Europe, neo-fascist movements have made scapegoats of immigrants to the point of murder. On the whole, governments in Europe have set their faces against these ominous trends. Yet, I was sad to see in Britain recently news of thinking about privatized immigration control squads. Astonishingly, promoted, it seems, by the government itself. Elsewhere, religious extremists have used violence to achieve their goals. Writers have faced death threats, and their associates have been killed for offending religious leaders. In the United States today, right-wing extremists are showing themselves to be more numerous, more organized, and more evil than ever. These assertions of particular narrower loyalties may be a reaction against many of the changes that characterize our time, including the forces of globalization and homogenization, and the currents of modernization and secularization. Whatever the proximate causes, these trends, whose common stamp is intolerance, take humanity back. They allow atavistic fears and hates to prevail over the instinct of human solidarity and fellow feeling. They allow the law of the jungle to replace the rule of law. They require us, therefore, to assert the importance of respect for the other people, other races, other beliefs, other colors, other cultures. The world community must uphold these values and offer protection against the actions of those who would trample on them. And a new order in the global neighborhood must help us to do both. We have celebrated this total period between 1945 and 1946, a year of victory in Europe. It was, of course, a noble victory. But was it only a victory over those who physically waged war? Were the dark forces of otherness not vanquished also? If they were not, we may have had less to celebrate than we thought, and more to do. If we are to do better, future generations must have an awareness, must have a perception, must have an insight of the world as a community of people needing each other for survival and having a common interest in the quality of the human condition. International cooperation is not a thing apart. It could be human destiny entire. It is not, as we once conceived it, a little bit of goodness measured in aid like alms on Sunday. It has to do with the structure of human relationships in all its facets. And this is where, I believe, education for life in the global neighborhood becomes so absolutely vital. And where the role of universities and tertiary education generally could be crucial to our chances. That education has to go beyond specialisms. It is why, for example, educational cooperation for development cannot be a matter for economists only. It's much too important for that. Much more is involved than having development economics on the syllabus of an Institute for Development Studies on the campus. The role of universities in international cooperation for development goes rather to the heart of the question, education for what? Are we educating for life in the global neighborhood? It really will not do, for example, to produce generations of scientists blinkered by belief that social issues like poverty and inequality within and between states are for the other culture, and that the scientific community will serve best if left to work untroubled by such distractions. Or generations of doctors, for whom medicine is the handmaiden of technology, and who see their professionalism distanced from the grim realities of rural healthcare. Or generations of lawyers, mindless of the social quality of the law, whose rule, of course, they passionately uphold. Custodians for whom loyalty becomes more virtuous than justice. Or need I say more academics, wedded to classical notions of pampered and privileged campuses, assured of preferred places in the small sun of their discipline, rather than a cadre of truly educated people whose horizons are the global neighborhood, and who see their own and their society's achievements not as ends in themselves, but as elements in the larger sun of human welfare. All these are among the questions that education for life in the global neighborhood evoke in terms of the role of universities. I am aware, of course, that there are bold spirits mindful of the new imperatives, enlightened men and women in science, in medicine, in law, in education, who do care beyond their disciplines, who do pursue them with a sense of responsibility that runs beyond frontiers of all kinds. But are they yet the mainstream of thought in their professions? Or are they small tributaries that trickle without trace into the stronger, older current? Education for life in the global neighborhood is so all-encompassing that our systems of tertiary education would be less than fully relevant to our times were they not to perceive and develop a role of substance and practicality in relation to it. Education, tertiary education in particular, must prepare us for living by global neighborhood values, values that help to make us see the whole world as our other country. The really sobering reflection, and a really encouraging one, is that people in that wider world, ordinary people, without benefit of scholarship, but wise in the knowledge of life, are coming to that selfsame truth and coming to it at a faster pace than on the whole are our philosopher kings. At the heart of the role for education, therefore, I would place the development of an ethos of the world as a single community we are. This means rather specially that true scholarship must help to liberate another generation, for it might be too late to free ourselves, from the intellectual shackles of old-fashioned sovereignty and from the cramping self-interest of the nation-state, from the related compulsions of an adversary system that divides rather than unites humanity, even in the pursuit of shared objectives. The world has become a global neighborhood, but we are yet to develop an ethic of community. We have made our planet a single habitation, man's science in particular, but it remains a house divided against itself. Homo sapiens could self-destruct unless he becomes Homo sentiens as well. Let me remind you finally of what Clement Attlee said as Prime Minister of Britain in welcoming world leaders to London almost exactly 50 years ago, on the 10th of January 1946, for that first meeting of the UN General Assembly in Westminster Central Hall. The United Nations organization, he insisted, in words that were to become more appropriate to an epilogue than to an introduction, the United Nations organization must become the overriding factor in foreign policy. And he explained his meaning thus. After the First World War, there was a tendency to regard the League of Nations as something outside the ordinary range of foreign policy. Governments continued on the old lines, pursuing individual aims and following the path of power politics, not understanding that the world had passed into a new epoch. In just such a spirit in recent times, in these islands, great nobles and their retainers used to practice private war in disregard of the authority of the central government. The time came when private armies were abolished, when the rule of law was established throughout the length and breadth of this island. What has been done in Britain and in other countries on a small scale has now to be effected throughout the world. That was not rhetoric for the inaugural. More than a decade before that, in the turbulent pre-war years, Attlee and others, including Churchill, had been calling for a universal Commonwealth of Nations. Founded in 1932 on what was described as an international society to promote international law and order through the creation of an equity tribunal and an international police force. 1932. The new Commonwealth Society has in its primary aim to reconstitute and revitalize the League of Nations as an international authority possessing the power to alter the public law and to enforce it. Lord Tweedsmuir, the novelist John Buchan, was one of its trustees. Harold Macmillan was a member of the International Executive Committee. Attlee himself was an early member of the British Commonwealth section, of which Churchill was the president. In 1934, the Society republished an exchange of open letters between Einstein and Freud called Why War?, in which these great men argued that the one sure way of ending war was the establishment by common consent of a central control which shall have the last word in every conflict of interest. Nearly a decade later, on the 6th of September, 1943. Churchill was to return to these convictions in his now famous Harvard lecture. If the League of Nations had failed, said Churchill, it was largely because it was abandoned and later betrayed. He saw as the central and creative task the working out of a form a system of world security may take, a task which included, as he saw it, coming to grips with, in his words, whatever derogations are made from national sovereignty for the sake of a larger synthesis. It is worth repeating that acknowledgement from so grand a supremacist as Britain's wartime leader. Whatever derogations are made from national sovereignty for the sake of a larger synthesis. It was mature enlightenment. We were becoming more fully grown. I cannot emphasize too strongly that in our global neighborhood, it is the primary duty of everyone, states and people alike, to support, not usurp, neighborhood action, in this case, UN action. It is also essential that UN intervention should follow principled criteria, be consistent and even-handed. Above all, that intervention must not be unduly influenced, much less determined, by the interests or domestic political agendas of powerful nations, within a region or globally. An activist United Nations would not long survive as a legitimate and effective body if it is ever used as a cover for the intervention of major powers. What we cannot allow to happen is for the global neighborhood to be policed by vigilantes, either because the sheriff is not being paid or because the rule of the sheriff's posse is actually preferred to the rule of law. It is as serious as that. That is precisely what the world was trying to escape in 1920 with the League of Nations and again in 1945 with the United Nations. And yet here we are in 1996 in the Balkans again, with internationalism displaced and unaccountable power rampant. Must we conclude, as Churchill did at Harvard in 1943 in relation to the League, that the UN in turn is being abandoned as a prelude to being betrayed? This simply must not happen. But it could happen. Unless we recognize the signs of regression and mobilize global support for the system, reformed, of course, as it must be, to ensure a return to the principles and the purposes of the Charter. If we were to face the 21st century without it, our global neighborhood will do so wearing the king's new clothes. What then is the essential role for education? Surely to be in the vanguard of changing the world through changing human perception of it and of ourselves in relation to it. We shall not have in the next century, we do not have now, the options of yesteryear. The way forward must lie in making this world new. Harlan Cleveland has written recently of the birth of a new world. Much earlier, Paul Eluard had reminded us that there is another world, but it is in this one. That other world here on this one earth, which we must better and more fairly share. It is the reality to which our global neighborhood summons us. To help our humankind to discover and inhabit it should not just be the role but the vocation of education. Education for life in the global neighborhood. Thank you. This method?
No.
All right. Secondly, Attlee might have been talking about world government. I am not. And if I gave the impression at any stage that I was, I'd like to correct that. Because I am not, and the Global Governance Commission is not. We do not believe that we have reached a point in human affairs where world government is possible. But larger measures of global governance, larger measures of international cooperation, more of doing things together universally, and not just sectorally or regionally, that is, I believe, the right way. And I would think that the breadth of the democratic impulse now and the depth of it across the world is such that we can be sure that those arrangements of governance can be made democratic. If you get into areas of global government, then you get into the difficult question that Attlee couldn't answer. And it's partly because those questions still remain unanswerable that we mustn't go down the route of world government.
Thank you. One more question.
Big question, Peter, because that's the, how do you do it? Just one or two very elemental things. First of all, recognize that while we are still a world of nation states, and let me say that in the context of an assertion that the nation state is not about to disappear. While we are still a world of states, we are much more a world of people than we used to be. And it is a world in which we have to accommodate players besides states and governments, in which we have to accommodate people, non-governmental organizations, civil society generally, in many, many forms, the private sector, to find ways in which all these elements come together in global governance. That's a very important mind shift. It's why I talked just now about sovereignty and why it's important to remember that in 1945, those great men from wide political spectra had all come to a point of convergence on this. I believe that is the fundamental way forward. I think, too, that there has to be radical reform of our arrangements of governance. That means the United Nations system in very fundamental ways. The gentleman asked about democracy. The United Nations today is an extremely undemocratic institution. We haven't got world government, we have the United Nations, but we have a very undemocratic United Nations, run by the major powers, the powers who won the war. The charter still talks about enemy states. That is the Security Council. Why wasn't this splendid occasion of the 50th anniversary of the first meeting of the United Nations that was held here in London, the one seminal act of the United Nations that took place in London, why was that not celebrated by the government on the 10th of January? Well, I'm not privy to the arguments. But was it because it was concerned with the General Assembly and not with the Security Council? Was it because it was concerned with that element of the United Nations system that most approaches democracy rather than with the one that least? So we have to make those specific changes. And in the report on global governance, which I commend to those of you who have not read it, you will find our specific proposals in relation to the many matters to which Peter's question alludes. Thank you all very much.
Thank you. We're ending with a lot of beginnings. What a marvelous address that has been. I think we're honored and privileged and illuminated. Fascinating to find you offering a kind of reconciliation of hope with some very harsh realities. You talked of a bouquet of flowers, but you also offered us a bouquet of nettles. I felt it was a remarkable way in which the larger synthesis, to use the Churchillian phrase, was achieved by you in such a small time. May I say personally what a relief it is to hear a statesman with all the grand themes coming down to the detail of what Dostoevsky calls the lonely and the poor who are very much alive. And we prefer our statesmen like Dostoevsky, for whom the lonely and the poor are very much alive, with all the grand themes of course. It's been a wonderful night. Thank you very much for your declaration of interdependence, which we will have printed and think about for a long time. Thank you so much. I think we're heading upstairs, though, if you have the time, to go on with this conversation. Perhaps.